Welcome to Hormone Health Podcast, brought to you by Georgia Hartman and Chloe Sheehan.
This podcast is an extension of Hormone Health Studio, which is our naturopathic clinic based here in Newcastle and online.
We're just two naturopaths who love a laugh, coffee, croissants, and conversations about real people with real health concerns.
Nothing's off limits. We're here to educate you on what's happening in your body, share emerging research, and debunk buried health misconceptions.
So sit back and let us do the talking.
In today's episode, we speak to Nat Kringoutis all about fasting. Now, there is a lot of negative talk and hype around fasting, and I used to be a big believer of if you're a female, you don't fast. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of seeing it work for different people and hearing from different experts and their experiences, I think there is a certain type of person that it could be beneficial for.
Yeah.
And Nat goes all into it today.
Yes, and into extended fasting, which is just so fascinating. So,
and her experience.
Yeah, she literally came off, like the day that we recorded this, she had come off an extended fast, so we got her fresh.
Fresh and fasted.
That's what we should title this episode.
Speaking of fasting, I had a really nice thought that I would come over to your place and we'd record this podcast and I'd bring a six pack of sticky date hot cross buns.
Have you had those yet?
Yeah, but they're sold out. There was only one left. No, two left yesterday. So I bought them for Will and I.
Oh my goodness. So the sticky date hot cross bun, this is a conversation in the back end of our clinic among practitioners because we're all so healthy. Because Kelly was saying that if you have been to Baker's, is it Baker's Delight?
Baker's Delight.
She goes, don't walk past Baker's Delight because they were sampling these sticky date hot cross buns.
Have you tried it?
No, I haven't.
I had all intention to get you some. They were so good.
Were they?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that'd just make me so nauseous.
Not if you stop at one. Not...
Yeah, that's my problem. That is so my problem, isn't it? I can't just have one square of chocolate or one hot cross bun. I have to have the whole bag.
I think you need to listen to this podcast.
Let's get into it.
Nat Kringoutis is a healthcare practitioner, author, speaker, and all-round natural fertility expert. She is the founder of Melbourne's women's health clinic, The Pagoda Tree, a best-selling author and most recently co-creator of her new line of health products, M-Body Minerals Absolute and MSM. What an intro.
I cringe at the intro. I'm like,
oh. Why?
I'd be stoked like, well, with what that. Else could you add? But it's been a long time. Like it's many, many years of, you know, the evolution, but I still get cringe a little bit, which is probably something I need to get over. Because it's none of it's a lie. So
part of human nature though, I think. It's quite humbling if you cringe.
Oh, that's nice. I do cringe.
Nat, today we are so grateful to have you on the podcast to talk about all things women's health. That is your area of expertise. And so we'd love to pick your brain.
Amazing. Georgia and Chloe, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's exciting to speak to someone that works in the same field, but with a different, not that different. We work alongside many acupuncturists and people who study TCM. So, but it's exciting to just see your approach and, you know, the differences in our practices. So can we start by asking you, how did you find your way to just studying a degree of traditional Chinese medicine?
Where did the start of that bio come from?
Do you want to laugh? I applied. So I did a degree in health sciences, but, you know, full transparency, back in the day, if you left yourself one subject short, you could just switch over to another subject and continue getting what was it called? Not hex and also like study payments. What was the name for that? I can't think of it. And so I was like, and I had no money. Like I was a student. So I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Cause I got to the end of health sciences. I was like, oh gosh, I don't want to do anything that this has led me on. And so I applied to study herbal medicine. And I thought I was studying Western herbal medicine. And when the acceptance letter came in the mail, it said Chinese herbal medicine. I was like, Oh, okay. Well, that's what looks like. That's what we're doing then. And I don't regret that at all, obviously. But it was one of those situations where I have to say, I haven't chosen any of this. It's all just come to fruition through living, and being, I guess, open and listening to what patients and people want. So I went on to study herbal medicine. I opened a clinic. I was very lucky through a whole lot of politics with studying in universities and whatever. I was able to open a clinic where many of my colleagues couldn't for several years. And then I added acupuncture to my skill set. And then I was literally inundated with women who wanted answers and weren't getting answers from conventional medicine. And I'm not saying I actually didn't have the answers, full, again, transparency. I had no idea how to help these women. And 20 years ago, we didn't view women's health and fertility like we view it today. And so I resisted that. And eventually, I guess one day, the umpteenth person asked, "Why do I have ovulation pain?" I'm like, "I don't know. I mean, I can treat it in Chinese medicine, but I would really like to be able to tell you from a physiological sense what's actually happening." And so I started to just go down rabbit holes and learn as much as I could. Even though I'd studied gynecology, it didn't set me up for what I was going to see in clinic. And by doing that, I just asked patients' permission to practice, which is what we're all doing anyway, right? We're all practicing. We don't actually know 100% of the time what we're doing is going to work. We're practicing. We practice in our modalities. So we got really busy really quickly. I didn't have the infrastructure. I didn't have the staff. I didn't have the what's the word? The experience and I think mentally, a whole lot of things we didn't have. But we did. And so it's just been a wild ride ever since. It was probably because of that decision to step into and listen to the patient and see what they needed and then start to do something about that. And fast forward, I mean, it all came down to what I was able to figure out was all of the symptoms and signs we were seeing with these patients were a direct result of their modern lifestyle. But science hadn't caught up to that yet. And so that's why we started talking about that and treating that and helping women, because a lot of the things that they were seeking medical attention for were not a druggable problem. They were a lifestyle issue. And so that's, I think, where it's really nice that herbal medicine can really fill the gap, because it's not about medicine necessarily. It's about everything you do outside of that. And we've continued to do that, and we just continue to evolve and listen to the patient. And I'm so grateful to do the work that I get to do.
It's such a good point, I think, because we too see a lot of people who have said, I've tried this, I've tried that, I've been on the pill, I've done the Mirena, I've taken antidepressants, I've, X, Y, Z, no matter what it is. And I still experience whatever the symptom is. And I think you're so right in that we're all just practicing on our clients, because a lot of the time it can present as really complex in terms of all of the symptoms that are going on. But when you strip it back, everything communicates to each other. So a lot of the time it is, okay, well, what's going on with your stress? What's going on with your relationships? What's your exposure to toxins like? Where, what do we need to change to get things back in balance?
And isn't it funny how at uni, when we're learning, we might do one subject of business, but majority of it is like how to be a practitioner. And then what do we do when we do get clients? And it's like, how do we work out, our hours and how much to pay ourselves? And so you're almost like learning and learning on the go, but then also doing like a side hustle business degree as
You know, I
well.
always say this. One of the things that I do that I don't advertise, but if you know and you're in my world, you'd know this, is that I do business mentoring for health professionals, because I never had that. And if I had, and I've made some doozies of mistakes, like, because I signed up to help people. I didn't sign up to be an accountant or a lawyer or even a team leader. I just signed up to help people. And I had to figure that out the hard way. You're so right. You get maybe what, at best, if you're lucky, 4 months of a subject on business that you might meet for once a week. It's not enough. It's really not enough. And also, as a green practitioner, to go out there and have to try and figure all of that out, I just wish someone had have taken me under their wing. And I really love to give that opportunity to practitioners, not only from a business mentoring perspective, but this is the other reason that I've been so solid on being able to provide a clinic where we take practitioners and give them a space to practice. Because I think that how else are you going to learn? And I would say to the person that is, you know, is new and is trying to do it all, it is hard. And it is important that you obviously draw on the strength of your peers. So you're so right. It is, I think that's the hardest thing, because we didn't ever think we were going to have to actually balance books and do some marketing and all of that that goes with it. And it doesn't come without it being another stress on all the things that we have to do.
Yeah. And for people who are listening, wanting to know what traditional Chinese medicine is, or TCM, and how it differs from conventional medicine, because it's not new. TCM is one of the oldest medicines of all time. And so in your sort of example, how would you define the difference between TCM versus conventional medicine?
Yeah, I really love to bridge the gap between the two. It's something that I've always been very passionate about doing. I would say we have a very integrative approach between Western or conventional and Eastern methods. And I guess one of the main things is that that I love about Chinese medicine is that, Georgia, to your point, we don't compartmentalize. The systems all work together. We have organs that all work together to create harmony in the body. At the end of the day, that's what Chinese medicine is all about. How can we make the body as balanced as possible? And so we do that in a few ways. We have various diagnostic techniques that, let me tell you also, guys, after studying 4 years of or 3 years of biosciences and then arriving in Chinese medicine, I was like, what are they talking about? This is not what happens. Does someone need to tell them that this is not real? Like, it took me a really long time to get my head around it, and I still struggle. But essentially, we get asked questions all the time, you know, how do the meridians work? So we use a meridian system to treat various organs and disharmonies within the organs. I guess an example, let's say, would be cirrhosis of the liver, let's say. So the liver energy is very stuck, very stagnant. We would use points along the liver meridian to help to open up and facilitate and move that stagnation from the liver. Now, that's a very basic description. And often disharmonies aren't solo. You don't just have a liver issue. It's going to be a systemic. So we use various points along the meridian, especially in acupuncture, but also in herbs, in herbal medicine, to facilitate and support that organ in whatever way it needs. So if it's deficient, we want to do things to tonify it. If it's running out of too much or excess, we want to be able to clear that and move that through the body. And then we look at various other aspects where we talk a lot about, and you would have heard qi and blood and wind and all sorts of other explanations that we use, where we can see external factors impact the way that our body works as well as the internal mechanism. So it is its own diagnostic system. It's very hard to explain with doing it justice in a couple of minutes. Fundamentally, we do look at things a little bit differently, and we definitely treat more of a root cause rather than a system, symptom approach. And so I do laugh now because everyone's about root cause. I'm like, we've been doing this for years, guys. But I'm all about it, because if we can be more aware of that, and I still think conventional medicine, even though we know this now, it still defaults to a symptom first approach. And it doesn't really take much consideration for the root cause and the long-term sustainability in treating something. So that's the other thing I love about Chinese medicine, is we generally go for the root cause. And in doing that, then we also treat the symptoms because we're treating the root cause.
Yeah, absolutely. And often you'll see people say, oh, I've got this symptom, I've got acne, but I've also got period pain and I've also got bloating. And they think that there's so much going on with them, when, you know, if you dig a bit deeper, you'll find that it's likely to be one or two things that are driving right. All of the symptoms. So yeah. I think, yeah, we practice in quite a similar way, naturopathic medicine to TCM, which is great. You guys obviously have the benefit of a whole nother system.
I joke with my girlfriend, who's an osteopath and obviously very, very clever, and so hands-on, and I joke because she'll say, what are you doing? I'm like, I've just got a patient lying there with needles in. She's like, far out. I've just been sitting, probably doing the same thing for 45 minutes with my hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get to like so pop the needles in and say, bye, guys, I'll be back soon, you know.
You rest.
Yeah, and I get to rest at the same time, which is hilarious. But, I mean, yeah, there's lots of different layers to TCM, and I think that it depends on, you know, which era you're looking at. You tend to gravitate as a practitioner to a certain way of treating, and there's more than one. You know, there's people that will come from what really attracted me to Chinese medicine was the whole gut pivot axis. Like everything pivots around the spleen and stomach in Chinese medicine, which is basically the gut, which we know now. But that really made sense to me. So I really dug deep into those theories and those diagnostic methods, whereas some other people might be more attracted to even older methods that are within the TCM, but it's still just theories. It's the same. It's just theories of how things work. So you kind of find what you're attracted to and you practice that and you practice what makes sense. And I think in doing that, you're going to get better results, because when something makes sense to you and you can actually translate that to your patient, you're going to get better outcomes.
Had you had acupuncture before you decided
never
start acupuncture?
And
I'm going to be an acupuncturist.
I didn't choose it at all. I think Chinese herbal medicine, I felt like I was treating people without the full kit and caboodle. And don't get me wrong, there's some incredible herbalists out there that only use herbal medicine, and I didn't feel like that was me. Even though I did herbal medicine first, I definitely do a lot more acupuncture than I do herbal medicine nowadays. And you just find the modalities that actually resonate with you. I still hate needles.
Oh, you hate needles.
I am so particular in who I let treat me.
Yeah.
I'm very sensitive. So, but having said that, my patients love that because I'm really gentle with them, and I'm not aggressive in my treatment, and we get results. So that's really all that matters at the end of the day. Yes, I hate needles. I had traumatizing experiences when we were, let's think about this. When you are studying acupuncture, you are in a room probably 4 days a week for at least 2 hours practicing how to needle people for at least 2 years. It's awful. Like, yeah, I just remember how many times someone hit a nerve or just like really like the needle really grabbed in a muscle, and it awful.
Yeah, you can feel it. Like
you
it,
can feel
straight
it.
Straight away your body just rejects it.
It's awful. So anyway, I love treating my patients with acupuncture. They can walk in with a headache and walk out without one. That's amazing. Or you can have very quick results. So I think getting a quick result with acupuncture is awesome, and a long-term result, but that requires consistency. And I think herbs and supplements can really fill in the gaps, which means the patient doesn't need to come every week or every twice a week, so long as they can stick to the treatment plan and fulfill and take whatever prescriptions that we might recommend. So that allows me to see more people and help more people, because I'm not having to treat as many people in a small space of time. And everyone's different though. That's how we work. You might go to a practitioner that wants to see you once a week, and that's completely fine too.
And for somebody who has never had acupuncture before, does it hurt?
It shouldn't hurt. I say this to patients all the time. This should not hurt if someone knows what they're doing. It tends to hurt when someone's a bit nervous, when they're a bit slow to actually put the needle, or I like to call it a pin. I think it's a nicer way of thinking about it. Because a needle is something.
It's bendy. It's,
right. Yeah, a needle is something that injects something or takes something out of your body. These are not tubes. These are pins. They're solid. And a pin just sounds a little bit less aggressive as well. So so no, it really shouldn't hurt. If you're going to a skilled practitioner, it really shouldn't hurt. And as I said, I pride myself on doing that, because you tend to attract people like you though. So yeah. I attract the sensitive people. So I treat them like I would like to be treated.
It's funny how it works out that way. Yeah, because I'm like, oh, interesting. You're very similar to me.
And I always say to patients, you know, if you are here and you go, this is awful, I do not want you to persevere. I will take them out for you. Mm-hmm. I've only ever had that happen once in 17, 18, 19, I don't even know how many years now. where someone was like, get them out, I can't handle it. But I use all sorts of techniques to calm people down, because it is scary to lie there and think about your body full of, you know, little pricks everywhere. But you can't
just
feel
to
it.
Relax. Like, I know. A lot of people, how often do they, in a daytime, would they get a chance to just lie there and be told, just focus on your breath?
Oh, so yeah. That's really hard to do sometimes. And sometimes I open my eyes and then I hear footsteps. I'm like, close my eyes, pretend. Let's try.
I know, but it's so funny. Sometimes you can totally get in the zone of it and really enjoy it. And other times you're like, nah, I just can't relax today.
Yeah.
How do you do it all in a session, in terms of, you were talking before about a lot of clients coming in, talking about lifestyle being, you know, the major factor here. How do you educate as well as relax as well as, and do you find that some of your clients just aren't interested in wanting to change their habits?
A couple of things to that point. I think I will say this hands down to anyone, and I say it all the time, I don't think I'm the most skilled acupuncturist or herbalist. I think I'm a great communicator. I'm very good at listening to people. I'm very good at enrolling them in what the, because let's face it, everyone wants an experience, regardless if it's their healthcare or a trip to the shops. They want to feel like it's an experience. I think where my skill set lies is being able to enroll the patient in the experience. And therefore, when you can talk to them in a language that they understand, that they're on board with, they will do it because they're excited about the outcome. Sure, I can give acupuncture. Sure, I can give herbs. And some people will argue and say, oh, no, you know, I'm as equally as good as someone else. I don't actually think I am. I think there's far more skilled people out there. But I do think that I have a fairly wide set of knowledge in women's health, but it all comes down to listening to the patient. I really think that. And the second thing I would say is to get outcomes with patients and get them to being committed, it's got to be the right price for the patient. So if it's not enough of an investment, research shows us that you won't get the outcomes. You have to be attached to going, oh gosh, that's a little bit more than I would want to spend, but you know what? I'm worth it. And they spend it, and then they get the outcome. And I do pride myself on, another thing I pride myself on is not requiring many, many treatments to get an outcome. I feel like we get quick results. And I think part of that is the fact that I get the patient committed, even though the prices might be more than what people think that they might be. They need less visits. So it's the same at the end of the day. Now, everyone works differently. There might be someone out there that doesn't like that, that might need to see someone 10 times to get an outcome, but their prices are lower and that works for them. And that's totally fine. But in my experience, the way I really feel that we get patients who are committed is to really enroll them in the process. And also, if you get the patient that's not committed, maybe it's not for them. And I'm very happy to have an honest conversation and say, I don't know if this is for you. Like, do you really want to be here? You have to do the work. It's not what you do when you're here. It's what you do when you leave. So interesting to that point too, we get incredible results with telehealth patients, with patients that are not local. And I think it's actually because they have to do the work. Whereas the patient that's coming into the clinic sometimes might think, oh, well, she's just going to give me acupuncture and it's going to make it better and I don't have to do anything. But you actually have to go away and take the advice that we give, do the things that we ask you to do, take your supplements, take your herbs, and that's how we get results. I like to keep it very simple as well. That's the other reason I think we get great outcomes, because if you go to your health provider and they give you an overhaul and it's 16 things that you need to do before you leave the house in the morning, I can guarantee you're never going to get results with that. It's too overwhelming. They'll do it for 2 days and go, I can't do this. And not to mention, it's not sustainable. It's expensive. So yeah, I guess there are three things that I do. I listen. I think the right price point matters, and less is best.
Yeah. And I think when you educate someone on what's happening in their body and you give them the answers that they're looking for, then they're committed. They Absolutely. Trust you. You've built that rapport. And as soon as that happens, you could tell them that the sky is purple and they'll go, okay, like, no problem. I must have been seeing it wrong all these years, but I totally trust what you're saying, because you've put in the work and the effort to get to know your client, but to get to know your art and skill.
And nothing's more motivating than feeling better and seeing change.
And that's really, for any practitioner that might be listening, that's the ultimate that's what you're aiming for. Like, what quick solution can I offer so that they see a shift in things and then they're committed? They're like, oh, you know what? I've gone to the toilet every day this week.
I'm just going to use that as an analogy. Like, who would you ever thought, like,
but it's like honestly, the ultimate. Like, patients are like, oh my gosh, you're so right. I've gone to the toilet every day. This is amazing. I mean, it doesn't feel nice to be constipated and it doesn't feel nice to be bloated. So two quick wins that you can give a patient means that they're already feeling like, you know what, she knows what she's talking about.
I've probably said this in previous podcasts, but my sort of rationale for anyone who's tailgating me or driving defensively, I'm like, Chloe, don't worry, they're probably just constipated. It's like, it's my way of justifying that they're angry and try to be compassionate towards them.
So funny. It's so true.
On that though, Nat, we saw on socials recently that you have just completed a 48-hour fast. So I would love to pick your brain about this. I'd love to hear how that went for you, if that's something you use in clinical practice. What's your take on like an extended fast?
I mean, it's not very Chinese medicine. If you had have asked me 5 years ago, I would have been like, oh, that's not really what we do. Having said that, I'm pretty sure most cultures for all of time, for whether it be religious reasons or longevity or whatever, have fasted. And so it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me that can be beneficial. I was a big fan of intermittent fasting for many years. I personally loved how I felt when I was intermittent fasting until I got COVID and then long COVID, and then I just couldn't recover. And so my old ways weren't working anymore. It wasn't actually until I stopped intermittent fasting that I found I started to recover. So that was a very interesting observation. It was like my body was under duress. Clearly my cortisol, my inflammation, everything was high. And it didn't resolve itself until I stopped. So I don't think anybody who is recovering from something necessarily benefits with an intermittent fast. However, I do believe that everyone benefits from a prolonged fast. And a prolonged fast is something that you might do at most twice a year, where you really want to try and get your body to at least 36 hours with water, black coffee, black tea, herbal tea alone, and salt, sorry, is the other thing. But ideally, my first water fast I did for 72 hours. And the way that this came around was I went to my integrative GP actually, and I'm like, I feel like I'm like 80% better from my long COVID symptoms. Now, guys, I still can't smell properly. It's been 3.5 years. So just there's definitely inflammation. There's definitely like something gnarly that happened there. But everything else is so much better. To that point, I had the most horrific eczema on my eyes and nothing was working. And I also, to that point, it's hard to treat yourself, right? You need to go and actually invest in somebody. So I had done that in various scenarios. But anyway, I'd gone to see her about something to do with something else. And I said, do I just still feel like I'm not there? Like, I really don't. She said, yeah, I think you should do a prolonged fast. And I'm like, I think you're stupid.
Isn't there a supplement I can take?
I'm not to be rude, but that's insane. Like, I'm not doing that. And I was so triggered by it. So triggered. I was like, I just don't want to do that. I just don't even, why? Anyway, you know, when someone says something to you and you're still thinking about it 3 months later, I was like, maybe she's right. I really don't want to do this. Anyway, I just woke up one day. It happened to be the right time in my cycle to do it. And so I just went for it. And so I did 72 hours. And let's be honest, I was pretty desperate. My eczema was at an all-time, like, eczema on your eyelids has to be one of the worst places to have eczema because you can't put anything on your eyelids topically to soothe it either because it immigrates down into your eyes. And then that hurts. So, and it's sensitive skin. So I was just like, was awful. Anyway, so I did the 72 hours and my eczema cleared up. I was like, well, I knew that was going to happen. I didn't want it to happen because I wanted to be like, no, see, nothing works. And it actually worked. And then because I was sharing it publicly, I had so many people so invested and interested in the process. And so I then was like, all right, well, why don't I guide people through not a 72-hour. It's pretty hard to get to 72 hours. I'm not going to lie. But 48 hours isn't actually that bad if you time it at the right time and have a couple of sleeps in between. And so I just really wanted people to have the opportunity to see how it's not dangerous, how their body feels, how much they're actually just in a habit of eating, all the things that your digestive system does outside of digestion, because it's pretty important, all the other things that it does. and give people an opportunity to have some support rather than feel like it was this island that they had to go and put themselves on and then be out there for a couple of days. So we've just completed one, actually finished today. And I mean, the comments on Instagram have been amazing. Don't get me wrong, there's some pushback too. It's always, people are always very confronted with fast. But I think at the end of the day, the research, what it shows us, if you can get the body to 24 hours, is that state of autophagy where your cells just go in and clean themselves out. There's research to suggest it helps to shrink tumors, it helps to treat cancer, and of course it really helps with our longevity and health long term, and gives you, you know, helps with your biological clock. So to me, it makes sense. If I can get my body to have a bit of a clean out from doing nothing once a year, then I'm good with that. And I always know that I feel really good after I've done that. So it is a bit of a mental game, but there's milestones of things that happen every step of the way. So this is what I enroll people through. It's like after 4 to 8 hours, all the food's left your stomach, your blood sugar stabilizes, and insulin, you stop secreting insulin. And then by the time you get to, you go through phases. So you get to a 16-hour mark where human growth hormone starts to be released. You get to a 24-hour mark. It's when you start to enter the phase of autophagy. And at the 36-hour mark, this is a really exciting thing, autophagy increases by 300%. Like, that's wild. That's why we want to get you to 36 hours. And then it's just time spent doing. It's time spent in that state. But the reason that you don't really want to go past 72 hours is it all maxes out at around that point in time. There's no benefit to going past 72 hours as far as what we know. But for women, we do need to be very mindful at doing it at the right part of the cycle. There are phases where you wouldn't do it, or it's not recommended. And they're really at the phases where you are building maximum hormones. So I would say the week before the period isn't an ideal time, because obviously
that's the chocolate phase, right?
That's the chocolate phase, exactly. But during the period, if you are fine and you feel fine during your period, that's actually okay to do it at that time. So I would say, it's okay to do it then. It's great to do it. Depending on your, so you kind of do need to know when you ovulate, because you don't want to do it just before you ovulate, because it's going to delay ovulation. Now, if you know that and you're only doing it once a year and you ovulate a little bit later, no, there's no harm in that, but you wouldn't want to do it every month. So this is why we have to be very clear about this. And then you've got a window after ovulation for several days where it's fine for you to do it as well, but you don't want to do it too far into the luteal phase, because you can really tank your hormones and you don't want to be doing that. So really, I think probably the most optimal time is straight after your period, or during and straight after the period. But you can do it at other times of the cycle. And like I said to everybody this time, don't stress about where you are in your cycle. Just know that if you do it too close to ovulation, your period's going to be late. And if you do it too, if you do it in the second window of your luteal phase, you probably find your period will be early, because there's just not enough hormone made after that second surge of estrogen to really support progesterone in that second part. So that's happened to me before. I've done that, and I'm like, oh, that's what happens if you fast at the wrong time. But you still get the benefit. Noted. Yeah, you still get the benefits of all of those things that I've spoken about. The anti-inflammatory effects for me have been profound. And then there's certain research now that also talks about women in perimenopause and menopause and the great benefits of doing it during those phases to support your hormones. And I'm in that phase. So perimenopause, at least, not menopause, but I really want to do everything I can to scaffold my body through perimenopause, because I think it's a slippery slope for a lot of women, because they didn't scaffold in the early part of perimenopause, and they find themselves all of a sudden everything just starts slipping away. So it can be really great if you do it and you know what you're doing.
I know Dr. Jason Fung is a researcher leading in intermittent fasting, but in one of his books, I think it's called The Ultimate Guide to Intermittent Fasting, he has a couple, but he talks a lot about the benefits with perimenopause and menopause. And I think particularly in this demographic where we're seeing a lot nowadays of insulin resistance and abdominal fat. Metabolic symptoms syndrome. Where something like this, and that's really the demographic that I find fasting to be just so beneficial for. Obviously, pace dependent, person dependent. I want to know though, coming off a fast,
what did you eat?
Yeah, was it a drive through Macca situation? You know, like for someone that's trying to reset their body, like I think a lot of people go, okay, I'm going to do a detox. I'm going to go buy all these things, do this really crazy anti-parasitic detox, when in fact, maybe if we just stopped everything altogether and just had water. But how do you come off it?
Yeah, great question. I think one thing to be said is whilst you're on it, I'm really strict with people using those things that I said, and then salt in their water for that electrolyte benefit. That is probably the most important part. And I don't want you to be up to your eyeballs in black coffee, because that's just going to send you, give you the jitters. But so that's a big part of it. I think the electrolyte part is a really big part of it, and really giving the body the clean out. Coming off, I think two things. If you know that you're intolerant to any food, please don't eat that as you transition off a fast. Everything's very clean in there. It's all ready to go. Your digestive system has shut down at around the 12-hour mark, 8-hour mark, something like that, and it hasn't been digesting food since then. So it's super clean. It's very, like, ready and very receptive. I would say warm-cooked foods, very easily digestible foods. So ideally, you could break it with broth or a soup. And as long as it's very nice and sort of, it's very soft, I should say. I was going to say mushy like baby food, but maybe not quite to that level.
That's what I was
envisioning. Really easily digested foods. I today also added a little bit of protein in for the first time, and I was completely fine. In fact, this is the best I've ever transitioned off a fast. I don't feel bloated. I feel normal. In fact, I feel better than normal. So that was nice, actually, because I've played around with a few different scenarios when coming off a fast. But I think, easily digested foods, it's very Chinese medicine. We avoid cold, raw foods. We put in warm cooked foods because the job's half done for us. And I think now that I've had the first meal and I feel fine, I'll be fine to kind of, I eat pretty well anyway, so I'm not really stressed about that. But for the person that really needed the reset, it's a good opportunity to keep the inflammatory foods, the sugar, the gluten, the dairy, the alcohol, on the lower side of things for a little while, or ongoing even, could be useful, just because the thing is, we can't flare and repair at the same time. You can't have your gut, you can't be flaring and then trying to fix it at the same time. It doesn't work. So this is a beautiful opportunity to really continue that restorative and repair process, because it's been doing that anyway, and continue with that. So, I mean, I think people probably got different ideas as to what they have when they come off a fast, but that makes the most amount of sense to me.
And could you describe or explain what autophagy is? Because mentioning that it increases up to 300%, and there's been some amazing research around autophagy. But could you explain?
Yeah, I mean, autophagy is that state that we get to where the cells actually, it's so wild that your body knows exactly what to do when you get out of the way.
It's like a full recycling system.
That's such a good point. When you get out of the way, your body knows what to do. I like that.
It's so true. Like, all you have to do is get out of the way and it knows. I say this again, and I'll answer your question in a second, but I say this to patients all the time. Let's say someone comes in with a fibroid and they want me to treat the fibroid. I will say, I don't need to target the fibroid. We need to support the body so the body actually targets the fibroid. It knows what to do when you can just create an environment where you're supporting it no matter what. So I really think that's what fasting does. I think the body is very, very smart. And autophagy is a state where your body is cleaning itself out on a cellular level. So the cells are actually giving themselves a spring clean and rearranging the furniture, so to speak, getting rid of anything or recycling or you know, any debris, anything that is in there as a buildup that it doesn't need that's getting in the way. Because you've got to think about cellular repair, right? If a cell is replicating and there's not enough of what it needs to do that, it will still replicate. It'll just be a dodgy, daggy cell that doesn't actually perform properly. It's like, oh, there's a bit of something I can use. And, you know, so it basically takes out the trash. It rearranges the cell. And we know that in doing that, this is the part that helps to, we believe it helps to minimize tumors and cancer risks, just because it's actually a deep cleanse. And I'd use the word cleanse really lightly. When I say detox or cleanse, your body's doing that anyway. It's not like, I'm going, oh, I need to detox, therefore I'll do a fast. Not at all. My body's already doing that. I'm just actually up-leveling its ability to detoxify.
Yeah, that's a really good explanation. Coming back to our conversation at the start, when you mentioned that you were getting all of these clients coming in and you were saying that the biggest influence you believed was how their modern lifestyle, what are some factors that people may be either unaware or ignorant to that may be negatively impacting their health in from a modern sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we know, anyone listening, if I was to say, oh, you need to eat better, sleep more, I think
we know, like, yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Nat. She's a genius. I'm so glad you got her on the podcast. I think the one that we discount the most, even though we talk about it, but we discount it the most and think that we're superhuman is stress. When I say modern lifestyle, and not to forget that stress isn't just being busy. Stress is the environment you put your body in, which could be exposure to toxins and chemicals. It could be the brand new house with the paint and the carpet that's actually full of toxins that you're not coping with. It could be the mold because you've been flooded. It could be that your liver's not detoxifying properly or that your gut health's average. So when I talk about stress, it's very hard to make people understand that stress is so many things, but it's the thing that we think we can outsmart, and we're not designed to outsmart it. And especially as we enter perimenopause and menopause, our body will borrow our sex hormones to make stress hormones. So not only are we already seeing a slow decline in our hormones, but if we're super stressed, our body's now borrowing progesterone to make cortisol, and therefore you feel pretty crappy with that as well. So I think it's very important to just, first of all, assess. We've got to become conscious. I say to patients, I can't sit here and say, don't be stressed, because that's ridiculous. And you're going to probably want to punch me in the face. But I can say, I need you to have more awareness about when you are feeling overwhelmed, anxious, stressed, worried. That's another big sign, or tense. I just need you to acknowledge it. I don't need you to do anything with it, but I can't help you fix it if you're completely unaware that you're in that state. So what that means is you might be rushing around and you might find yourself sighing, because that's what we do when we're stressed. We don't take a proper breath in. When you can actually catch yourself doing that, then you're going to be like, oh, okay, there you are. Yes, Nat, you're stressed. And that will happen time and time again throughout the day. But if I don't acknowledge it, then I can't do anything with it. The other thing I say to patients is, I want you, when you're feeling that overwhelm and that anxiety that comes with having to do a lot of things, can you write a list down of all the things that are actually stressing you out in that moment? Because chances are there might be one major stressor in your life. I think most of us can identify the stressor, whether it's family or circumstances or job or money or whatever that is. But then look at all the other things on that list, and do they actually warrant that precious release of cortisol or that stealing of your hormones? Is that actually what you want to happen right now? And obviously the answer is no. And so I think just being aware is the game changer for my patients. When I say to them, what's the biggest achievement or what's the best thing that we've done here? They always say this, oh, when you asked me to get aware of my stress levels. I'm like, is that it? I can retire now. But I think it's just because it's simple and it's not actually a lecture as such. It's just becoming aware of something, and then we can add layers onto that and go down that rabbit hole. But I do think that it is the most underestimated biggest issue that we see, and women don't realize. And also, the other thing too is we often have learnt to be stressed from our mothers. I think our mothers' generation were the first generation where they were balancing way more than any other generation. They were working and had young kids. Whereas if I think of my grandmother was at home looking after us as kids, right? So they were the first to really do that. And that's what we model what we do off what they've done. But
right.
Right,
that's my problem.
we also have so many tools at our fingertips to actually make our lives easier that they never had.
Absolutely.
And so you've got to be mindful also, are you stressed because someone's telling you how stressed you are? Often our mothers, and I love my mum, goodness bless her, and my dad too, but often they'll say, oh, Nat, you're just so busy. And so what do you do with that? You hear, oh, I'm so busy. So you adopt something that is their opinion as your fact, and then you play into how busy you are as a woman. I play a game when someone says, and I get it all the time, people are like, oh, you're so busy. And I have this thing that I say, oh, that's cute. You think I'm busy? Because A, I get to do a lot of things, but B, I don't do them all. You know, I have people that can help me, or I've worked out strategies or systems. I have processes in place that allow me to do all the cringy things that we spoke about. You're probably busier
when you first started, when you had that inexperience of starting a business and doing all of that.
Absolutely. So my point here is, you know, if someone is telling you how stressed out, how busy, how this or that you are, can you just check in and go, oh, that's cute. No, that's what it might look like, but I'm actually, I just get to do lots of things, and because you're doing it anyway. This is the thing, you're actually doing it. So you don't need to be worried about that. But I think we just have to be able to plug in awareness. We do so much on autopilot, and it's the autopilot that's actually subconsciously stressful that actually then is a cascade for all of these other problems that we're seeing and all these other misfirings that happen in our body that show up as all sorts of symptoms depending on your predisposition.
Yeah. And one final question for you, a personal question. Has your experience of perimenopause changed the way you treat perimenopause? And were you aware that you were transitioning into perimenopause, or potentially was it just some symptoms that popped up?
It's a great question. I think every step of the way I've always been very excited to experience something that I can then properly take my patients through the journey.
Yeah.
So I, you know, 10 years ago, if someone wanted help with perimenopause or menopause, sure, I could help them, but I hadn't had the experience. So I felt like I could meet them somewhere with that, but I couldn't take them the whole way. And the same with fertility and pregnancy. I mean, the way I used to get, when I was a new prac, the way I used to get patients to get up on the table before I'd actually negotiated a belly is really embarrassing. I apologize to any patients in the mid-2000s that I was like, oh, yeah, just get up there. It's not until you've actually been pregnant you realize it's probably not as easy as just getting up there. Mm-hmm. So with perimenopause, it's been very interesting. I'm still trying to figure out what was long COVID and what was perimenopause. And maybe it wasn't long COVID, maybe it was perimenopause, although perimenopause shouldn't cause me to not be able to smell or give me eczema on my eyes. So I think it's a bit of a combination of both, but I'm now probably, I've really accepted that this is the, well, we're in this phase from mid to late 30s anyway, like it's just the next transition, right? But I've really taken on a new appreciation for my hormones as I'm 46, as a 46-year-old, and I really feel like I'm going to be able to live this, to be able to help patients more than I'm already helping them. And I'm happy to be the guinea pig, and I'm happy to figure it out, and I'm happy to experiment. So I don't have all the answers, but I can tell you a lot now about perimenopause that I didn't know before because I hadn't experienced it. And I also think we're so lucky to, because again, to the point of what I said before about our mothers just accepted that those symptoms were part of getting older, right?
The hysterectomy generation.
Right. We know better, but we don't have a generation of experience yet to be able to go, oh, this is what you do. It's like we're living it now. Yes, okay, I look up to some, you know, women in their 60s and 70s and but they only got curious when it was maybe just too late. Like what happens if we actually got curious before we were in it and then during? And I feel like that, and again, that scaffolding, I call that, scaffolding around our bodies, I'm so excited to see how I can transition because, again, I'm still every day confronted or asked by women, what do I think about HRT? Do I need to go on HRT? What are my thoughts on that? And it's like I just don't buy the fact that your body can't know what to do.
Yeah.
Like it, yeah. No, again, get out of the way and let it do what it needs to do. But getting out of the way means you do have to prioritize sleep. You do have to look at your stress levels. You do have to look at your nutrition. And that can feel overwhelming unless you just take it one step at a time.
I think a lot of the time it can feel overwhelming because at that particular point in life, potentially you have adult children, you have aging parents, you have your
Yes.
career, you have your mortgage. Like there's
maybe
just
break down a relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's just so many
It's so
pivotal
much.
points. There's so many balls in the air that thinking about your own symptoms and your own health, you just think, oh, you know, it's like, I don't have the
100%, I
capacity for
agree with
that.
you. Yeah, I do. I agree with you, Georgia. I think that what I will always say to the patient is, this is going to be really terrible if you don't prioritize yourself because you've got
Absolutely.
all of these people relying on you. You have to do this now. Like, this is a non-negotiable. You have to come first. The nice thing is, whilst you've got all those balls in the air, your children aren't little anymore. You're not changing nappies. You don't have to necessarily be there when they get home from school, or if they're adults, you know, they can fend for themselves. You've got a bit more time to do these things. So prioritize that. You know, I'll go to an appointment and I make my next appointment before I leave. I have rules in place now. My favorite rule, and I know not everyone has this luxury, but my favorite rule is I do not start work on a Monday until 11 o'clock. That is a non-negotiable. Can I tell you, that makes Mondays amazing. I like every day of the week, but, you know, Monday's the start of the week and you're like, okay, let's go again. Like, I'm excited for the week, but there's still a little bit of an underlying, it's Monday.
That went quickly.
You start at 11. Just let me tell you, it's almost over before it's begun. It's fantastic. Just little things that have really made a big difference. And I also think we're wise enough to advocate for what we want.
Yeah.
And so really step into that. You've spent your whole life probably people pleasing. And now it's time to actually take a bit of that back and actually ask for what you want. Show people how you want to be treated. Set some good boundaries up. Nurture yourself. Look after yourself. Because if you don't, your body will tell you it's in all sorts of signs and symptoms and it won't be happy and you'll be miserable.
I do love the, like, I'm not taking shit from anyone attitude of perimenopause and menopause. And every single time that I meet someone who I had, there's this one client of mine who I just adore. And the first time she sat in the chair across from me, she said, I've got this tire around my belly. If you're not going to help me get rid of it, then I don't even care anymore. it's so refreshing to have.
They've got that life experience.
Yeah. They're like, I don't need.
Yeah.
Nothing from nobody.
No, I mean, it is particularly interesting as you feel and watch your body change. That's a hard thing to watch. Again, to my point, it's why you have to actually do some groundwork now before it actually spirals out of something that you, because we've all seen a woman transition through menopause and she looks nothing like herself afterwards. And I don't want that for anybody. So it's like we need to do it now so that you don't get to that point, and we need to be as healthy as possible. And our health metrics change also. And, you know, I can't tell you how many women, I bet you've had this as well, will come in and say, I'm exercising more, I'm eating less, it's not working. It's like, because things have changed. That does not work anymore. Yeah, they have. So let's figure that out. Let's scaffold. Let's figure out. And, yeah, to this point, I think this is, again, where we can make some little shifts that will really support our health. But if you're stressed, you can't thrive at the same time. It's just not going to happen.
I feel really empowered about working in women's health, but just talking about this and that, I think the thing that's a real take home for me is that we in general are just more curious about our health. And I think that's, you know, that's a really good thing to have.
You're so lucky.
Because we are. And it's like we have the luxury to be curious and want better outcomes. So thank you so much for deep diving with us and also sharing a bit of your personal health as well.
Of course. Thank you so much. Like I said at the beginning, it's such a pleasure to be here. So thank you for having me.
It's been great. Thanks, Nat.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode.
If you liked it, leave us a review and follow us on socials. We'd love to hear from you.